Good evening. This is John L. Payne, your host with Soul Matters Radio, talking to you from the heart of London. And this evening, not in the heart of London, but in the heart of Virginia, is author Susan Inger. She is the author of The Undefended Self and has also been a teacher and practitioner of the pathwork for many years and runs a retreat in Virginia called Seven Oaks Retreat. Good evening, Susan. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, John.
So, I read your introductory notes, and I felt somewhat of a babe when I read that you were at the march when Martin Luther King gave his famous I Have a Dream speech, and that was part of your spiritual awakening. Please tell me about that.
Okay. As a young woman, I was teaching English at Howard University, which is a traditionally African-American university in Washington, D.C. And that summer, I was working for the Congress of Racial Equality. I was a 23, 24-year-old woman, and was asked to be a monitor, which in hindsight seems like the height of chutzpah that I could think that I could actually monitor that crowd. But anyway, it's hard to convey now, but at that time there was a lot of worry about bringing that many people together and black and white, and the media were putting out quite a bit of alarm. In fact, of course, it was a huge gathering, completely peaceful, August 28, 1963, still remember it clearly. And so I was part of the crowd and also a monitor, and there was a moment, and I am not certain it happened actually during Martin Luther King's speech, but certainly that was the highlight of that gathering. And there was a spiritual presence to the man that was extraordinary. And as I looked out over the crowd, I had what I would say was my first spiritual awakening as an adult, first spiritual experience as an adult, in which I knew that the entire gathering there of black and white was one consciousness, that there was only one human heart beating in these many manifestations. It was complete. It was like I knew it all along. I had always known it. But it was extremely clear at that moment. And, of course, King was speaking to exactly that, you know, I have a dream that we can realize that oneness, really, was what he was saying. And it was a lived experience for me in that moment. So, and then I was, you know, I stayed at Howard for several years, and I was in Mississippi for the summer of 1964, which was the big so-called Freedom Summer, where they registered many, or attempted to register black voters and so on. So it was a very exciting time to come of age.
So what dream became born within you when you heard, I have a dream? Clearly it stimulated you in some way.
Well, it's a nice metaphor. Initially, it was the specific dream of the movement of liberation for all people, regardless of color and race and so on. But it really evolved for me into a dream of inner liberation, not so much the political level, but the spiritual level. And that during my time at Howard, it was mostly directed in the outer political realm, but I soon got involved in encounter groups and alternative kinds of therapy. This is still the mid-60s. And then in 1969, I went to Esalen Institute, which was kind of the granddaddy of all the growth centers in California. Met my future husband there, who is still my husband, and also became really opened up to the inner work, not just the outer work of liberation. So in 1970, we were married in a Buddhist ceremony, actually, and then came to live in Virginia. And we didn't initially dream of having a large center. We just wanted to do our own, at that time, kind of small encounter group business, because we got trained in encounter groups and trained in bioenergetic therapy. But we were eventually looking for land of our own, Is this more story than you want, or is this?
No, absolutely. Continue. I am. If I was watching TV, I'm glued to the screen.
Okay. Good. So, we were looking for some land of our own, but it's, you know, something small to just do our little business of encounter groups. And actually, a woman we knew had 130 acres, which she gave us at a price that already meant to us that this land was meant for a lot more than just us.
Right.
It's a beautiful piece of land, overlooks the Blue Ridge Mountains, has river frontage and a pond and so on. And so from the beginning, we had a sense that the land was actually calling for a larger vision.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't know initially what it was for, and we thought, since we were Buddhists at that time, that it was going to be a Zen Buddhist center.
Right.
But that isn't how it actually evolved. What happened was that in the summer of 72, I was in training in bioenergetic therapy, as I mentioned, with John Paracas and Al Lowen. And John brought his new wife, Eva Paracas, to a training. And I just had this moment of falling in love with her in the spiritual sense of knowing that she was to be my next teacher. So that began in 1972, my long relationship with the pathwork.
Right. You've mentioned a couple of things. You talked about bioenergetic therapy.
Yes.
Could you tell me a little bit about that? What is that? Do you still practice that?
Well, that was the precursor to core energetic therapy, which
right.
people may have heard of. But Al Lowen and John Paracas were patients and students of Wilhelm Reich, who
right.
was the first person to really bring the body into therapy, mm-hmm. at least from a Western perspective. You know, it had gone from, I think Reich himself knew Freud. And so, but Reich worked very much with the body and with breathing to energize the feelings. And then Al and John put together a series of exercises that could loosen up the body energy to loosen up the blocks in the energetic flow and so on. And then we studied with John and Al Lowen. And then after a while, John separated from Al and went with Eva to create a more spiritual-based psychotherapy.
Right, which then became core energetics.
You
talk about releasing the body's energy. I'm feeling from what you're telling me, you're not talking about improving circulation, but you're talking about something that's beyond those purely physical things. Am I right?
Both and. Certainly the whole premise of any kind of body psychotherapy is that the body reveals the psyche, that there are actually two sides of the same coin, so that the depth of the ability to breathe, for example, is very much related to the kind of inner freedom. If
yes.
the breath is blocked, then the energy psychically will also be blocked. So it's really not two separate things, the body and the mind. The body expresses the mind, you might put it that way. But so what the exercises that they created were mostly to put the body into a state of involuntary vibration, not involuntary in the sense that you were forced, but just the kind of the way the breathing and circulation are involuntary processes. We can actually put our body in certain stress positions where the body will then start shaking, and that
right.
shaking will sometimes break loose buried feelings and things that we've been repressing. So,
yeah, I read something recently talking about how wild animals, when they've had an encounter, let's say a deer or a buck has had an encounter with a predatory animal, let's say with a large cat, and so they've been running away, and once they get free of the large cat, they shake their body in order to shake all the trauma out.
Right.
And so you're saying that human beings do something a little bit different to that?
Well, it's similar, actually. There's several books on working with trauma that talk about that. Waking the Tiger, I think, is one of them.
Yeah.
That I can't remember the author's name, but
Stephen Levine,
yeah,
I believe. Yes.
Not the spiritual guy, but yeah. Anyway, he has done a lot of work with comparing how the humans deal with trauma with the way animals deal with trauma, and yes, sometimes we can learn a lot from animals about how to shake off trauma.
Right.
So because what we do often instead is to hold it and freeze it in the body.
Mm-hmm.
And then when things start vibrating and moving in the body, then, you know, the breath, if you voluntarily get the breath going deeper, for example, that frees up more energy, and then things start happening that start releasing what had been held in the musculature.
And so when you talk about energy, what do you mean by that? Do you mean about the way in which the body is able to process carbohydrates and release those, or are you talking about something non-physical here?
Well, it's, again, there's no either or, but the kind of energy that we're talking about releasing usually is what I would say is emotional energy, the kind of
right.
energy held in feelings, and behind the feelings are usually deeply held beliefs about
mm-hmm.
the nature of reality and the nature of ourselves, that many of which are misconceptions about the nature of reality that have formed in childhood as a protective device. The child is always trying to understand their reality, and if their reality, for example, if their father is abusive, then they will grow up with the idea that men are abusive. It's an
okay.
incorrect assumption, but it's an assumption that is based on their childhood reality. And then that's not just an idea in the mind, but also the feelings are then held in defense and protection of that belief.
Okay.
And then the body will reflect that as well.
So it's held in the physical body, so that can affect posture, breathing, body size, shape, length, width,
sure.
Lines on the face or shoulders, anything along those lines.
Sure, the tension in the neck and shoulders, the way the chest may be caved in a little bit to hold the breath so you don't have to feel how frightened you are, for example.
Right.
All of those things, yeah.
So what is the most common misconception that we as humans carry, in your view?
Probably that life is not safe.
Right.
Love is not safe.
Life is not safe, and love is not safe. And so where do they come from? Where do those misconceptions come from?
Well, it's there are many different levels that you can talk about, but in terms of any particular lifetime, it is, as many people point out, it's fairly traumatic to even come into life. It's very few people have a totally smooth entry into life, and a totally smooth breastfeeding, warm, cozy, you know, so on. You know, everybody has some experience early in life of shock or fear, and it's very easy then, depending on the level of the trauma, you know, it's easy to create such a belief. Again, you can go back if you are into past lives. You can say we come in with certain limited beliefs about life.
Right.
And in fact, what this whole human incarnation is about is we begin with a limited idea of who we are, and then we can expand that.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the most fundamental limited idea of who we are is that we're human beings. I mean, ultimately, the greatest spiritual teachers will say that's not our true identity either.
And so what would you say is our true identity?
Well, that which we are is not capable of being put into words, so it's very difficult to be spoken. But if it had to be words, it would be more like we are life, we are love.
Right.
And so the initial belief that love is not safe or life is not safe is our initial separation
Mm-hmm.
from that universal love life force, which in fact we are not separate from. We are, that is what we are.
So you're talking there about a non-physical state of beingness. Is that right?
The state of beingness, that's right.
Right. And so let me just recap here a little bit. So there you were at an historically very significant event, especially for the United States, the I Have a Dream speech with Dr. Martin Luther King. And then an awakening occurred within you. And then a little bit later, you meet a woman called Eva Piragos, who teaches the pathwork. And then you got involved with that. So tell me what happened there with the pathwork. What does the pathwork mean? What did the pathwork mean to you then, and what does it mean to you now?
Okay, I want to insert that probably the most significant of all of those events, of all the history that you just recounted, was my meeting of my husband, Donovan.
Right. Okay,
We are each other's most fundamental spiritual teachers.
Right.
And have been for nearly 40 years now. Well, more than 40 years. So I would say, in terms of the impact on who I am and how this growth has come through this body mind, that meeting was the most significant. But meeting the event with Martin Luther King and Eva were also important meetings.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a very strong connection to Eva, and pretty soon I started going to New York to listen to the lectures and begin to be part of have sessions with Eva and so on in 1972. And shortly thereafter, Donovan joined me. So we were going, and the two of us were part of the initial leadership group that grew around John and Eva. There were maybe 15 people in that group or so. And it was a very exciting time because we would go and we would listen to her deliver a new lecture. Every month there was a new lecture. And in between times, there was a question and answer period with her, and she would go into trance and deliver the pathwork lectures.
And what were the lectures about? What was the nature of the pathwork?
Well, the pathwork is a contemporary path. It does not arise really out of any particular religious tradition, although there is an opening, a suggested opening to the Christ consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
But the pathwork is not Christian, not Buddhist, but also kind of all of those. She was opening herself to a level of spiritual guidance that came through that was teaching about the nature of being human, and particularly the nature of personal transformation,
mm-hmm.
what it takes to get from here to there. From our normal, unconscious, neurotic ways of being in the world to a more expanded, more conscious, more loving way of being in the world.
So was that just a new set of dogmas, rules, and regulations that were delivered, or was there something a lot more substantial that was contained within these lectures?
Well, it certainly is not a set of commandments mm-hmm. whatsoever. It's really outlines a process for working on oneself
mm.
and shedding the layers of more outer or, I guess I would say, falser identification to learning more and more to identify with the core of what we are
mm.
as spirit. And the basic process outlined has to do with dropping, first of all, recognizing and dropping the masks.
Right.
There's all of the roles, first on the outer level, all the roles that we play and all the shoulds that we tell ourselves about who we ought to be. And more deeply even, learning to identify and drop the character defenses.
Right.
The ideas about, that we have incorporated about, how we think we can best defend ourselves from life and love.
Okay.
And they're different, and different ones of us have different defenses, but
mm.
that those defenses are still, in a sense, part of the mask.
Mm-hmm.
My book, The Undefended Self, is the one that shows, you know, how this process works as you go through the layers of dropping the outer levels of the mask and then the deeper defenses. And then we often also have to meet and come in contact with essentially the core negativity, or that in us which does separate from life and love, which says no to being fully in the stream of these great forces. So, and that which the pamphlet calls the lower self.
Right.
I don't know what you call it, but it's a separating force or energy. And the work of uncovering the layers includes having to uncover that the layer of our negativity.
Right.
Without that, the work is can be very shallow.
Can you give me an example of the mask? What is the mask? How does it play out in our day-to-day lives? Or how has it played out in your life, if you want to give a personal example, or just a general one that we can all relate to?
Okay, well, I'll first say that the guide, the Bethel guide, gave three major types. Many of the psycho-spiritual paths have certain typologies, like the Enneagram and so on. The particular typology here is very simple. It's that the three types are those who, and they're based on certain core or higher self qualities that have been turned into distortion.
Right.
So the three qualities are love, power, and serenity. And these are true core qualities, and in their essence, we all have, of course, all three of them. But those with the love mask are often ones who have adopted a solution to their problem of their childhood pain. They've adopted the mask of being a loving person, which often actually is submissive. I'll needing approval. I'll do whatever you tell me.
So it's ingratiation.
Ingratiation, right?
Right.
So that's one of the principal masks. The power mask is more or less the opposite, which is the way I'm going to escape my childhood pain is to be aggressive and powerful and bullying and on top of things. And
I don't need anyone. I don't need anything. That kind of thing.
Well, that can also be the serenity mask. The power mask is I'm going to control my environment and I'm going to control you, and that's how I'm not going to get hurt.
Right.
The submissive mask says I'm not going to get hurt because I'll agree with you, and that's how I'll get you to love me. And I need your love. And the power mask says I'm not going to need you, and I'm going to defend against being hurt by being more powerful than you are and by being aggressive. And
as
the third mask,
as you're describing that, I'm actually thinking that even entire nations take on those roles.
Even what?
Entire nations take on those roles in terms of how they place themselves in the world.
Uh-huh. Entire nations.
Yes,
entire
nations.
This is true.
Just a couple of countries popped into my mind as you were talking about those.
Yes,
about how nations and ethnicities sometimes posture themselves in the world. So it's individual and it's also collective, these masks.
That's correct.
It would seem. Right.
Yes. When I first went to Brazil, we taught a lot in Brazil. The Catholic is quite strong in Brazil. And it was very clear that they were perceiving, and I think not inaccurately, the United States as a power mask, you know, all about will, all about control.
Well, I was thinking about George Bush when you talked about the power mask, to be very honest with you, and about that administration, and about some of that power mask posturing there, and that also equally applies to some nations here in Europe as well, of course.
Right. Yes, well, it very much is it's been the norm here for the U.S. And I could see it more clearly when I was in another country.
Yes.
I was looking back at my country and being appalled at it. And similarly, though, Brazil sometimes, not so much now, they've gotten a lot stronger, but they used to have a more of a love mask. You know, everybody's friendly, everybody hugs, everybody's sweet, you know, but it's harder for them to own their anger and aggression.
Right.
Anyway, the third mask, just to complete that particular teaching, is a serenity mask, which is basically the defensive withdrawal. So that one might also say, I don't need you, I don't need anybody. A lot of spiritual people have that mask. You know?
Yes, indeed.
I only need to connect with God, I don't really need anybody else. And so those are the three masks that the Pathwork talks about, and that are deeply... when we start out in looking at ourselves, we often don't even have any idea that we're wearing such a mask. We're so clearly, so fully identified with it that we can't even see it.
I was just thinking that myself. How can one become aware of one's mask?
Well, one of the things that's useful in any spiritual path, and certainly as a part of the path work, is that you get the reflection of other people in a group that makes a commitment to reveal themselves to each other. And at some point, you know, you start getting that feedback. Of course, in a really good relationship of intimacy, you'll get the same thing. Like, you know, why are you being aggressive with me? I love you. Well, I'm aggressive because I'm used to being aggressive when I feel threatened. Okay, let's take a look at that, you know. you know, and similarly with the submission or with the, you're withdrawing. Why are you withdrawing from me? So the feedback of other people is very important, of that kind of mirror. We need mirrors in order to see ourselves clearly. It's very hard to do alone. But it's also true that once you read these ideas, you can start looking for it. And one of the practices in the pathwork is to keep a daily journal where we review the day and start looking at any disharmonies we have during the day as an opportunity to look at where we were caught in our mask or our lower self.
So this requires a lot of self-reflection. It requires honesty. And it requires integrity. In my experience, most people on the planet are, and including myself at times, looking for the magic pill or the magic wand that can make all the pain go away and to make it easy. But it seems that what you're saying is that this requires awareness, self-awareness, integrity, honesty. It sounds like a lot of work. So what are the rewards to make it tempting? Tell me about some of the rewards. I've got to get off all these masks, which might be uncomfortable and might feel very threatening. So why would I want to do this if my mask is working for me? Or at least
it never really is working because it's not who you really are.
Uh-huh.
So in order to come in contact with your essential nature as love, as life, that the true joy of life itself, one has to no longer be identified with the periphery of consciousness or the mask, but dip down into the core. Mm. And that core is what makes life worth living.
And so you're saying that we go through this process of perhaps pretending to be content and happy with life to touching into moments where there is genuine bliss or contentment or happiness with life and existence.
Right.
Right.
And once you have begun to touch that, it's never going back, because that's really, you know what's real. And the mask level of, well, I got what I wanted, doesn't satisfy anymore.
Right. And so, obviously, you've had this very rich spiritual partnership with your husband.
I do.
But the pathwork and similar teachings, the way in which you've been working, what has it done with your other relationships, such as with friends and siblings, family, and associates and business colleagues? How has it transformed your life that way?
Well, let me speak about my mother for a moment, because mm-hmm. that was probably where my deepest wounding this lifetime was. Just to speak psychologically for a moment, you know, I grew up in an era when babies were not held except every 4 hours and then bottle fed on a schedule and so on. And I grew up with a strong sense of deprivation of maternal bonding. And so this became, you know, a major issue. It became a major issue psychologically that it was hard for me to have women friends, and I distrust women, and I was very distant with my mother. Having felt that she was distant with me, and the work, and I did a lot of work, you know. I started therapy in 1964, for heaven's sake, you know,
right.
In one form or another since then. So eventually working through the belief that I was wounded, ultimately is what it's about, because I came to discover that my essential nature as a woman was in fact full of loving connection, and that it was not, that wound was, while it had to be, I had to feel the pain, I had to feel the anger, I had to feel the loss, I had to feel the lack of forgiveness, and then the forgiveness, you know, finally seeing my mother simply as the woman that she was, without the demands of the child that she be something other than that. With all that came a great softening with my mother, and then a marvelous, my mother died about 3 years ago, and I was there for the last several weeks of her life, guiding her in the passage. And it was an extraordinary experience of being completely able to be with her with no leftover triggers or childhood agendas. You know, I was simply there with this woman that I loved and whose limitations were, on the personality level, were clear to me. But as she was passing, there was just, it really felt like I was able to offer her in her dying what had not been able to be offered to me in my birthing, just because of the times and the hospital environment and everything. She died at home in my arms, and it was a powerful experience of complete union of mother and daughter, which had not, you know, it took those years of work to make that possible.
So how do you feel now about your fate with her? You were born to her, and that set up certain patterns,
right,
a certain pathway. How is that now for you?
Well, totally accepting that that was exactly what needed to happen. And
mm-hmm.
one of the things that it opened for me is a very powerful experience, which is, you know, of the Divine Mother. I mean, I've carried my healing to that sort of transpersonal level of needing, of wanting and finding a connection to what I have called the Divine Mother.
Mm-hmm.
So, had I not been, well, so-called wounded at the,
right,
in that childhood way, there might not have been the impetus for that kind of growth into a relationship with that archetype, and that has been very healing for me.
A couple of minutes ago, you used the word forgiveness. My experience is that many people struggle with forgiveness because often they come from the point of view of the good forgiving the bad, or the better forgiving the worse, the superior forgiving the inferior. What does forgiveness mean to you, and perhaps specifically with regards to your mother, or just in general? What does that mean? Because there seems to be so much misunderstanding about what forgiveness is.
Well, there are several levels, I think. The
mm-hmm.
On the psychological level, forgiveness is a recognition of the inevitable limitations that each of us has as human beings, that is simply to be accepted. When we can find full acceptance of that,
right,
those limitations, there is a natural forgiveness that flows from that. It's like, it just is how it is. You know, my mother was who she was, given her conditioning and her upbringing and the beliefs at the time, and she thought she was doing the most modern thing in the way she mothered me, you know. And,
mm-hmm.
and so once one gets that larger context and sees the person not through the lens of the child's unmet needs, but through the lens of an adult having seen another person simply as another person, there's a flowing in of acceptance, and then I think forgiveness follows very naturally from that. There's a deeper level that I'm most interested in right now, which is when I can live in the more essential, the essential nature that is so hard to talk about, but that part realizes that it was never wounded. It simply, you could say, attracted these experiences for the growth of the outer being. And there, in that sense, never was anything to forgive. It was just all the drama that had to play out in order for this growth to happen in the way it happened. So that's, but not everybody's ready for that. And
right.
It is important. It's very important also that forgiveness not be a commandment that then truncates a process that may need to involve a lot of anger and rage at what happened.
Right.
For example, if you tell somebody who's just uncovering childhood abuse that they need to forgive their abuser, you're probably not going to get all the work done that you need to do. You need to go through the outrage and blame and so on. But
mm-hmm.
if you stay there, you're obviously, your growth is going to be limited, because
right, yes,
until you can move all the way through the anger to the simple awareness that they were doing the best they could too. Everybody's doing the best they can.
And sometimes we get hung up on forgiveness because we're waiting for the apology to come. Once the apology comes, and then I can forgive you. And clearly that doesn't work either.
No, you can't. Forgiveness is an inner process.
Yes.
It comes from one's own willingness to drop the case you have against that person or life or
mm-hmm.
love, and to say, it is as it is. And that's the simplest thing. It's just the self-awareness, or the awareness that things are as they are. And if we fight them, we're just who's going to lose, you know?
Indeed. I have a thought about forgiveness and that I'd like to share with you and to see what your thoughts are on this. I've often considered that one of the reasons why forgiveness is quite challenging is because we generally come from quite a punitive society. Uh-huh. Our religions are based on if you're bad, you get punished. Uh-huh. And so I know that for some people to forgive someone else who has hurt them either maliciously or even unconsciously, that they can't do it because the person, the offender, the abuser, first needs to be punished and then I can forgive. And I think sometimes we're caught in this punitive mentality that we've received from our religious traditions, and that sort of stilts the whole forgiveness process. It's something that I've mused on over the years, and I wanted to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, that is a mindset that can be helpfully investigated, that punishment, it will actually make you feel better if the person is punished. It's probably not true. I mean, if you really look at it, is it really, do you feel better when you get punished? Well, some people say that, yeah, then I feel less guilty if I get punished.
Right, yes.
So, you know, it's just something to investigate. It's not really, I think, how life works. I mean, there is a natural karmic, you know, what goes around comes around idea that, you know, what if you are really hurtful, that probably you'll get that back at some point. But
right.
Life can be trusted to do that.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have to set that up for other people. I don't find that it's very helpful. And
right.
This may take me a little bit into something. I wanted to talk a little bit about the book I'm writing now.
Yes.
And this is a book about my, about many different things, but at one level it's the story of my journey with my daughter, who was a very active drug addict for 10 years, and it's really the story of our spiritual growth through that dreadful disease. And the thing that became very clear to me is that addiction is very often viewed punitively.
Right.
And addicts are bad and should be punished and so on, and of course the jails, especially in this country, are filling up with untreated addicts.
Right.
And
in the United States specifically,
yes.
You're talking, yes.
Right. It's just a horrendous percentage of addicts are now in jail and not getting adequate treatment. Anyway, what I really became clear to me is even though addiction and often causes people to do very bad things, if it is treated, if it is punished in that way, mostly what happens is that the guilt gets worse and therefore the need to use drugs gets worse.
Mm-hmm.
And to numb the guilt because the guilt is too painful to feel. Whereas if an addict is treated with compassion and acceptance, that's not to say that, you let people get away with murder at all, but you have to set your boundaries and so on. But if...
With addictions, we're still responsible for our behavior.
Yeah, of course, you're still responsible, and if you do something that's clearly illegal and wrong, you will go to jail. But on the other hand, if the only crime is actually using the drugs, then that's questionable to me whether that's the best treatment. My experience with my daughter is it is not. Every time she was in an environment that was punitive, she got worse.
Right.
And every time she was in an environment that was recognizing this as a disease and helped her to come to a compassionate stance with herself, a forgiving stance with herself, she got better. So that might be my my real life answer to my own experience with punitiveness versus compassion.
So you're talking here about your daughter. I'm assuming that you were busy with the path work prior to her being born. Was there something specific that happened in her childhood, do you think?
Well, the attempt to get explanations for the disease of addiction is a very common one. I mean, she is adopted. She had a horrendous first
adopted.
Year,
right.
a horrendous first
okay.
year of life. Both her parents had trouble with alcohol and drugs. So, you know, you could say that that was it. But what is simply true is that she has a disease of addiction. And once you
right.
have it, you process substances differently from other people.
Right.
And your mind operates differently from not addicts. It's a chemical imbalance that is genetic, it seems, and it's some people have it and some people don't. And if
right.
you have it, you will not be able to process substances the way other people do. I mean, for example, most of us, when we drink too much alcohol, get a hangover and get the message, this is a bad idea.
Right, yes.
An alcoholic drinks too much alcohol and gets the message, I need more alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
That's how the body works. The body mind of an addict or alcoholic works. It's very different. And it's, you know, some of the young people who experiment with drugs experiment and it's done. And others experiment and go the way of addiction.
And continue. I have a question for you. Do you think that your journey with your daughter would have been different had she been your biological daughter and not your adopted daughter? Do you think it was less or more challenging, or do you just don't know the answer to that question?
I don't know the answer to that question. It's impossible. I do know, just from a human point of view, it gave me the fact that she was not my biological daughter. I probably used that to feel a little less guilty.
Right.
But even so, the guilt and self doubt and I should have done this, I should have done that, why didn't I, you know, all of that kind of anxiety and doubt and self questioning
mm-hmm.
was very intense for me
mm-hmm.
with her, and I don't know if it might have been worse if she was my biological daughter, but it's really hard to say. I mean, it's just that what I had to learn was I had to learn a lot of things, but it drove me very deep into myself, because we've been talking earlier about the layers of the mask. I mean,
right.
everything was exposed, you know.
Yes.
All of my ideas about myself were challenged. And ultimately, even the idea that I was, that I was on a spiritual path with a
mm-hmm.
particular goal in mind was becoming a more loving person,
mm-hmm.
even that was challenged, and it was...
Well, I'm sitting here thinking this, because there you are, you're there with Martin Luther King listening to I Have a Dream, that takes you onto this spectacular piece of land, that takes you to the path work with Eva Piragos, and I understand you've been teaching the path work, you've worked as a therapist, and now you have this adopted daughter with an addiction. And I was feeling into that. How did that challenge you? Did that challenge your faith? Did it? It seems that almost your world turns upside down. So
yes.
What has changed?
Well, you and I talked about this in a brief conversation we had before, in a time when one is faced with a huge crisis in your life, it is... It's actually an opportunity to let go of the worldview that you've been holding till that moment.
Right.
At the time, it doesn't feel like an opportunity at all. It feels like a shattering crisis. And yet the shattering of any idea about reality is ultimately necessary for reality itself to present
yes.
itself.
Just as sometimes the heart has got to break in order to open.
Exactly. And the name of my book is Love Unbroken. And I'm going to read you the quote from a contemporary American teacher called Gangaji. I don't know if you've heard of her, but...
Yes, I have.
That is the basis for the book, which is... Because he says, and this works for everybody, whether your issue is an addicted daughter or something else, he says, opening to whatever is present can be a heartbreaking business. But let the heart break, for your breaking heart only reveals a core of love unbroken.
That is exquisite.
Isn't that exquisite?
It is absolutely exquisite.
And that was my journey. It was letting my heart break over and over. And in the heartbreak, also was letting the mind break, letting the mind's ideas about reality break. I don't know. I don't know. This expert tells you this point of view. This expert tells you that point of view. This school says this. And, you know, we tried it all. By the way, she is now very clean and sober and a wonderful young woman with two terrific kids and a happy grandparent. But it was a long journey. It was an intense journey.
And in your life, you've hung around with some great spiritual teachers. And to me, it sounds like a death process that you went through.
It was. It was a kind of death process. There's a wonderful pathwork lecture called The Spiritual Meaning of Crisis about every crisis will confront your beliefs about how things are. And it's really an opportunity to let those beliefs shake apart so that something new can be born. In fact, you know, the whole Western society is probably in such a crisis modality right now where a lot of the beliefs we've held about how things work are breaking apart. And it can be a wonderful opportunity, say, to just drop into the only place from which real spiritual wisdom can come, which is, I don't know.
Right.
I don't know.
So really into the unknown.
Into the unknown, exactly. Mm-hmm. And that willingness to be heartbroken open, mind not knowing, can lead you to the experience of what Gangaji calls love unbroken.
Mm-hmm.
That's that which is underneath everything and which is what we are.
As you're speaking those words, I'm hearing some echoes of some of the interviews that I've heard with Eckhart Tolle talking about the power of now.
Sure.
So it sounds to me, and correct me if I'm wrong here, as if the pathwork for you has evolved into Susan's pathwork, something slightly different. How has that evolved within you? And in terms of your approach to it, do you still call it the pathwork for yourself, or has it evolved into something new?
Well, the pathwork, as I practiced it in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, is so thoroughly in my bones at this point that I mean by that is that my willingness to look at anything that arises in my experience, unflinchingly to look at my own negativity, my own limitations, my own false beliefs, my own meannesses, that habit of mind that is willing to be completely honest with myself, that I owe to the pathwork. I mean,
right.
That came from years of that kind of self-confrontation. And it is indispensable on the spiritual path because otherwise you can bypass or try to skip over things. And the willingness to investigate whatever is here, including pain, including one's own negativity and so on, is an important feature of it. I would say that one way that I feel somewhat different from how the pathwork is mostly practiced now is that it is, a lot of people doing pathwork are still doing basically inner child work, you know, where they need to look at those misconceptions that were formed in childhood and unravel the misconceptions and feel the feelings that weren't allowed to be felt then and then come more into their adulthood. And that's very important work. I would never, but it's not mostly work that comes up for me anymore. It could, you know, I'm not saying it might not, but mostly it doesn't. So I find myself more interested in is watching those habits of mind that still might make judgments or of myself or of others, which then limit my experience. So I have worked in the last several years with the Byron Katie work of the Four Questions. I don't know if you know her work, but it's
yes, I have heard of her work. Yes, yeah.
Or Gangaji, or Ajishanti is another American teacher who's very deeply awakened man. And these deeply awakened presence, I guess. Anyway, these teachers are what is mostly mostly following now as a way to integrate the awakening that's come to me. And it's a little more than the pathwork as more generally practiced, but it's certainly certainly not an either or. I mean, there's a continuum. And what Donovan and I are mostly teaching now is what we would call the path of awakening.
Right.
And we are, for example, we're doing a workshop over New Year's, which will be based on the new book called Love Unbroken, and then the Awakening the Heart from Its Ancient Sleep.
Awakening the Heart from Its Ancient Sleep.
Yes.
Mm.
That's from a quote by Hildegard de Bingen, who talks about spirit awakening the heart from its ancient sleep.
Okay. I just want to ask you for a moment, because obviously you have a book that's out, and many people have read it, and many more people could read it, The Undefended Self, Living the Pathwork. What is the message and the teaching of this book? What is the gift that people can receive from reading The Undefended Self?
Well, the main message is it is possible to live in the undefended self. It is possible to live without the defenses that we normally believe we need to protect ourselves from emotional hurt. It is possible to live in the kind of open, vulnerable, unknowing space that actually is where the most joy and aliveness live.
Mm-hmm. And are there exercises in the book?
Oh yes, it's actually almost a textbook, and that's why it is used at Barbara Brennan's school and elsewhere as a text of the pathwork. But a text for working on yourself. You don't have to call it pathwork.
Right.
But it does outline the process for going through the layers of defense, which I was talking about earlier, and the three different kinds of masks and so
mm-hmm.
on. And then it also, and how to meet the lower self and how not to be terrified of one's own negativity.
Right.
And how to then learn to shift your identity and identification over to what could be called the higher self or the essence or the core. And so it is a kind of step-by-step process, and at end of each chapter there are exercises to do to help you work on your own. And people have done this on their own.
So it's a workbook.
And in that sense, it's kind of a workbook, yes. It's also used in the transformation program that is held here at Seven Oaks and elsewhere. And I just wanted to put in a plug for that, because there is a transformation program starting at the end of October. It's a 4-day, four times a year program.
Mm-hmm.
And people come from all over. We also have a long-term residential program here that people come for 10 months living at Seven Oaks. And we've had people from South Africa, from Nicaragua, New Zealand, et cetera. So they come from a long way and can benefit from these programs.
I'm just looking here, the title of one of the chapters is Transforming the Lower Self, and the quote is, "Through the gateway of feeling your pain lies your pleasure and joy." And that's from one of the pathwork lectures.
Right.
And so the book would seem, because there's meeting your higher self, it would seem quite a complete text in terms of looking at our defenses and giving us exercises or examples that might help us to move through that.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. Well, I did come across some pathwork material myself a little while back, and whilst I thoroughly enjoy the basic teaching of the pathwork, some of it, because I believe the material is mostly from the 50s and 60s, seemed a little bit archaic, especially in terms of some of the comments that were made about homosexuality or being gay. What do you have to say about that?
Well, I would agree with you that a lot of the language feels a little archaic to me now. I mean, when I read Eckhart Tolle, for example, the language is so fresh and new and
yes.
present, you know, and it's so accessible. And some of the pathwork guide lectures are really convoluted and difficult to understand. And I do believe that they were not all of the transmissions were at the same level of depth or integrity. And there's been quite a debate within the Pathwork community about some of the guide's statements about homosexuality, and basically I think they should be discarded. They're simply not from the same level or at the same level of...
So I'm understanding what you're saying is that Eva Parakos was channeling then this material.
Oh, yes.
Uh-huh.
Well, I saw her. She, from 72 to 79, she died in 79, I was present for every one of the lectures that was given, and she would go into a light trance, and she clearly was, and the voice that came through didn't even sound like her, and afterwards she really did not remember what was said.
Right.
Although she always felt very refreshed, she said, after it. But she was in a trance when it was given. Mm-hmm. What interests me also is at the same time she was channeling was also the woman who channeled A Course in Miracles was also in New York City channeling that
right.
at the very same time in the same place, but a slightly different take on the same reality. But I think that there's some things in the Pathwork lectures that are of less value and less accuracy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't think you find any text that's, I mean, certainly the Bible has some very strange things in it, so let's just assume that there were some.
Well, I should imagine it's quite difficult to find a human being who can be a pure, unfiltered, unmasked, uninfluenced channel for spirit.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, even some of the really, I don't know Eckhart Tolle personally, so I wouldn't know, but because his writings, I have not found a false note.
Right.
But Adyashanti is a marvelous teacher, a fountain of clarity. And now and again, he just hits some place where it's just not so clear. So,
right.
You know, I mean, it happens.
So what would you say to, let's say, if there are some gay people listening now who may have some woundedness around religious and spiritual teachings that have been telling them for centuries that there's something wrong with them, who might feel reluctant to look at the Pathwork as there are a couple of statements that might seem negative? What might help them to overcome that, to clearly get some of the benefits of the work?
Well, one of the things that might help is that we have several gay helpers.
Mm-hmm.
Who are very committed to the work and also very committed to the, I'm not committed to, but you know, who are gay.
Right.
And who have no, don't find that conflict. I mean, they would be people to talk to.
Okay.
About what they've done, how they've resolved that in themselves. But I know that Eva herself, I did not feel that Eva herself was prejudiced. I mean, I knew well one man who came out as gay with her help. And found a lover that settled into a good relationship, and it was Eva was all in favor of it. So, I mean, she herself, I believe, was very much believed that love was the issue, not sexual orientation.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you for that answer.
I don't really think that need be a barrier to someone, although I understand that there is wounding there.
So tell me a little bit about your new book. When's it coming out? What is the title? What's it about? And because I certainly want to hear a lot more from you. I've really enjoyed our conversation. I've absolutely loved it. So tell me a little bit about the book.
Okay. Well, it's called Love Unbroken, and I'm not entirely sure what the subtitle is going to be, but probably it's going to be A Mother-Daughter Journey into the Heart of Addiction.
Mm-hmm.
Since it is the journey that we made, in a sense, into addiction, my daughter's addiction to substances, my addiction to helping her. I had to do a lot of work on myself as well, and it's an exploration of addiction, but it's also an exploration from a spiritual point of view, which is very different from what is normally out there. There are some memoirs, addiction memoirs out now, and there are even some from parents. In fact, there's one from a British woman who wrote an addiction, a memoir about her son's addiction called Lost Child. But they at their best still see addiction just as a disease, and that is important. That disease model really helps for the addict and their family not to feel so bad and guilty and so on. But there can be a larger perspective, which is that everything that comes to us comes for a purpose of healing and growth. And the journey into addiction is a very severe test of faith and a very severe journey to the depths of our own issues. But if it can be viewed as that, and if people can be helped to view it as a spiritual journey, it really can even be a heroic journey. I use the metaphor because it's very real for me. It's a kind of shamanic initiation.
Yes.
Because in the shamanic initiation, the person has to face their own insanity and their own prospect of their own death. And my daughter faced those, and I faced them in myself,
mm-hmm.
and came out the other end.
And so when will this book be available?
I don't know. I don't yet have a publisher. I have a book agent who's a very good agent in New York, and he's taking the proposal around to publishers now, and we will see who will publish it. It's a mix of the story and of spiritual teaching,
mm-hmm.
back and forth. It kind of goes back and forth, and it includes some of her writing and mine, and it also introduces, I don't know, how close are we for time? Because I could go on.
Just continue.
Okay. It also introduces yet another path that I have been following for the last 13 years, which is a Brazilian shamanic path. And that has been a very important part of my healing and of my daughter's healing from addiction. And so that's going to be, and that's perhaps the most controversial aspect of the book, because the path includes the ritual use of a sacred, of a psychoactive substance, which
right.
is used as a sacrament.
Right.
And so one of the things that this book will do in terms of breaking new ground is to introduce the possibility that these plant substances that have been used for millennia in the shamanic traditions around the world can actually be helpful to addicts.
Well, I enjoy a little bit of controversy, so I look forward to reading that. Susan, when your book comes out, I would love to have you on as a guest. I have been enthralled listening to you. And so just one final question. So there you were at the speech, I Have a Dream. What is your dream now for the future? Or from today onwards, what is the dream that's living with you at the moment? Or your vision, if you like.
I feel stumped for words. I really don't have an answer to that. I am very open to how it wants to live through me now. That
right.
that which was awakened then, or began to be awakened then so many years ago, is more and more available to me. More and more available. I don't even want to say to me, because that's not what it is. It's more and more available, and I believe it's not just more available to me. I believe there are many, many people waking up now.
Right.
And that it is about following that movement of that which wants to wake up in us and aligning with it, being willing to go with it, and willing to die to the old so that that new can be born over and over again, and keep moving out in the world with that new, that newness, that love, that life that we are,
yeah.
and that wants to move without the obstruction of our ideas about who we think we are.
Sounds to me as if you dream of being the presence of awakening.
I dream that the presence of awakening more and more live through this vehicle and through all of us. Yes.
Yes, indeed. Thank you so much. You have been listening to Susan Fasenga, the author of The Undefended Self and the author of the new book that is coming out, and I'm so much looking forward to speaking to her again when that material is available. This is John L. Payne, the author of The Healing of Individuals, Families and Nations, speaking from Soul Matters Radio in the heart of London. Thank you, Susan, and good evening.
Bye. Thank you, John.